I'm Dime Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch. The Willamette Writers Conference is July 29th through August 1st, and the whole conference is virtual like it was last year. As always, the conference has an impressive lineup of presenters for workshops, masterclasses, one-on-one pitch consultations, and manuscript critiques. And if you're a serious writer who is seeking publishing, this is a conference to attend. You can find out more about it and how to register at willamettewriters.org. The keynote for this year's conference is a writer I've been wanting to interview for a long time now. Heidi Duro is the author of the 2010 bestseller, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, and the winner of the Penn Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction in 2008. Her book was chosen as one of the best novels of 2010 by the Washington Post and made the top 10 book list of 2010 at the Oregonian. Now, I first met Heidi Duro when I attended the Mixed Remixed Festival, which she founded in Los Angeles to celebrate Loving Day. That day marks the end of the ban on interracial marriage in the U.S. Mildred and Richard Loving were sentenced to a year in prison in 1958 because they got married. They won the U.S. Supreme Court case, Loving versus Virginia, in 1967. Heidi's the daughter of a Danish mother and an African-American Air Force man. My dad was also in the Air Force, too. And she grew up overseas in Turkey, Germany, and Denmark. And then in 1980, her family settled in Portland, where she attended Jefferson High School. Her book, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, though a work of fiction, has some resemblance and details to Heidi Duro's early life in Portland. And it's my extreme pleasure to talk with you, Heidi, finally. Welcome to Stage and Studio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
I've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time. The timing just never seemed to work out. Now, you came to Portland in 2019 for the Association of Writers and Writing Programs when it was held that year. Was that the last time that you were in Portland?
I actually was in Portland right before the shutdown of the pandemic, but just to see family and visit with them. And thank goodness, that was actually the last time I've seen them since the pandemic. But it was the last time I spoke in Portland. So I'm excited to be part of this conference this year, even though I won't be there.
Yeah, it's still like you're there, right? Because you're still connecting. Now, your family still lives in Portland, or you have family still in Portland?
Yes, yeah. I still have my father's family there, and my brother and mother still live in Portland.
Have you found that people are more accepting at all? You know, the experiences that you had with racism in the 1980s, do you feel that that still exists, you know, from your observations coming here as a visitor, visiting your family?
I think I may not have a clear eye around that issue at this point because I come in as a visitor, kind of as an alien, as an immigrant, kind of to that Portland experience. And also the city has changed so much in its demographics. So when I was growing up in Portland in the 1980s, I lived in Northeast Portland, which eventually, I guess maybe it's still called the Alberta Arts District. But when I was growing up, it was just called Dangerous. And all of the gang shootings that happened around that time in the 80s happened within maybe a 5-block radius of my house. So, you know, my experience of dealing with issues of race was very different than what it is now. That neighborhood is thoroughly gentrified. My mom isn't the only white person who lives there. When I go there, you know, I experience the city as a grown-up who, you know, has a lot more wealth than I had as a kid. And so it's hard for me to tell, like, is it just class or is it also race?
Yeah.
The other part is, you know, I miss those communities, those minority communities. You know, I don't often see Black people when I go back to Portland, even when I'm back in my old neighborhood. And that's a little bit strange and disorienting for me.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of longtime Portlanders who grew up, my Black friends who've grown up there, that you just don't see that kind of community there anymore. And I bet, you know, what was it like, you know, during that time going to Jefferson High School? And did you feel really connected to people there?
You know, it was an interesting time because it was a time of great flux for that neighborhood. So you know, these were long-standing Black community people who were actually starting to gain generational wealth. And then here comes the crack epidemic, and then the crushing recession, and the loss of jobs. I mean, there was a lot of despair, I think, back then in the 1980s, and particularly like the mid-1980s. And at the same time, there was some hope. You know, Jefferson High School at that time, I don't know if it's still a high school now. I know that they were making changes a few years ago, and I don't know what happened to it. But at that time, it was a magnet school, and the magnet schools each had a specialty, and ours was performing arts, as well as television production. And even though it was in a Black neighborhood, we had quite a number of white students, and we were also starting to get some of the Asian immigrant students who had come in, who had been refugees and then had come to Portland. And so it was strange to see that I was going to a very diverse high school. And then, unfortunately, there was a segregation within that, so that there weren't that many African Americans who participated in the performing arts program. I happened to be one of them. My brother was one of them. There also weren't many of the African American students who were participating in the honors classes. So, I mean, I think I had a pretty hybrid experience of every single thing that happened during that time. There was a lot of hope for us, but there was a lot of despair. And I remember the thing I wanted most to do was to figure out if there was another place to be where I wouldn't have to feel so schizophrenic all the time.
Did you find acceptance as a mixed race person, or did you even identify as that back then?
I've been talking about this a lot since my book came out. So, you know, for the last 10 years, 11 years. And as I look back on it, I remember feeling really lonely in that experience. But the truth was, there actually were a lot of mixed race kids that I knew who were at my middle school, at Harriet Tubman, at Jefferson High School. It was just, we didn't talk about it. We didn't even know we were allowed to talk about it. We knew that if we brought it up, we would be questioned about our allegiance and our alliance with whatever group we were supposed to be with. And so for me, I just didn't say anything about it. And I tried my best to fit into the ideas and identities other people assigned to me.
Yeah, I remember, you know, I'm like an earlier generation with you, and I really connect, you know, with your overseas experiences. And my dad was also in the Air Force, and I just remember moving around a lot and having to adapt really quickly at each move. And then coming to the States, you know, when I was 8 and settling in Oregon when I was 10, and just that feeling of, for the first time, I never really thought about being Asian at all or in an interracial family. And then all of a sudden, it was like made aware to me by other people.
It's so funny you say that. I wonder if a lot of people have that experience when they've been a military family, because if you had asked me what I was before I came to Oregon, I probably would have said I was American. And then I got to Oregon, and then I had to be African-American. Or I guess we weren't African-American even yet. You know, I was Black. And that was just confusing to me, because I hadn't known that my family was different or that I was different. You know, I knew that people were sometimes struck by the fact that I had blue eyes, and they thought that was strange, but strange good. And it didn't have any more significance than that. And then suddenly it did in this new community that I was living in.
I connect with that so deeply. I had a Black friend when I was in kindergarten on an Air Force base in Japan. And we were both just Americans. I mean, so I connect with that. It's like there were Japanese students and then we were the Americans.
Exactly. There were the Germans and we were the Americans. And those were the dividing lines. And at that point, that's what was really important. And then suddenly you had to have a hyphenated identity. I mean, I should also say that in my own family, we didn't talk about race. And I think part of that was because my father, who born in 1937, segregated Dallas, Texas, I think he had a belief that if you talked about race, that racialized you in some way. And my mom was from Denmark, and so she didn't have a concept of race. She came from a homogeneous country and community. And if she were to talk about what our difference was, she would talk about our cultural difference, because we spoke Danish at home. We celebrated Danish traditions around holidays. We ate Danish foods, or, you know, we had a lot of Danish stuff in our house. And so, you know, it's just very interesting to figure out, like, what makes difference? It's kind of like, well, who's looking at you? Who's experiencing you? And then they're going to call what makes difference. And you can't really name that in yourself because you feel whole.
Well, you know, I really feel that connection with you. And, you know, I think that this is the experience that once we start opening up about talking, well, once, not opening up, but just once we start talking about the mixed race experience or mixed race experiences, because each one is so different, what connects us is the very thing that you were just saying, that sort of, you know, having to navigate different cultures and then, you know, your parents especially, and how your relationship to them are. And those kind of experiences, I don't think are as universal to monoracial adults or even children, because I think that this is just, it adds a complexity and a layer to it, or many layers to it. And I find that being mixed race, especially coming from times when there was not even names for what we are, you know, and having that fluid, constant kind of self-examination for what our identities are, is something that is very unique to mixed race or biracial, multiracial people. And I find I can connect with other multiracial, mixed race people quite often easily in these conversations. There's sort of an ease and a relaxation about it, and because I don't feel like there's going to be a judgment and these questions that are often asked.
The main one being, what are you?
Exactly. Exactly.
What are you?
You know, that's always on a top 10 list of things not to say to a mixed race person. And can you explain why not to say that, and why it would seem offensive or just off-putting at all?
I mean, gosh, I feel like I should have a ready answer to this, right?
Well, you've wrote about it on your website too. You have a whole piece about it. And it's just, I kind of know for myself, but I'm just wondering, it's just such a common question, because that what?
I think that's the start of the problem. It's the what are you? Like, you're a thing, a something that has to be labeled, contained in some way. I think the what, as opposed to who, is very disorienting, because, you know, I'm lots of different things. You know, I'm a coffee drinker. I'm a writer. I am a wife. I am a friend. I am a reader. I am someone who likes to drink out of straws. I don't know. Like, what are you doesn't really allow me to include all of those things, which are all actually important to me, not in that order at all. And then also that feeling of being not normal. What are you? Makes you sound alien. It makes it sound like you don't belong to anything that could be imagined. And that's a terrible feeling to have, that you don't belong to anyone or anywhere or anything.
I liken it to a puzzle that needs to be figured out.
Yes.
Rather than a person.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
You have all these pieces and people are trying to make it fit somehow.
Right.
The other question I get a lot is, how did your parents meet? And it's often like within, like, just revealing what my identity is. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, how did your parents meet? You know, it's like, how does anybody meet, right?
They met at a bar.
Well, they actually did.
mine too. That's why I said that.
I mean, you know, military, you know, how else, right?
So. Yes, exactly.
But, you know, it's this assumption that people don't just meet and fall in love like monoracial people do, or their monoracial parents do. You know?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Especially when they're a stranger and you're like, they're asking. So those are those kind of questions. Are there any other questions that you've been asked that are on your top 10 list?
I feel like I've been so traumatized by them. I can't even conjure them right now. And you know, it's been such a strange year and a half for so many reasons. I haven't had to deal with these kinds of questions in so long. I've been in Los Angeles and have been able to be at home most of the time. Thank goodness, as a writer, I don't have to go out and about. So I've really been at home for a year and a half. And when I go outside, I would wear a mask. So that would be another layer of obfuscating my identity. So I, you know, I've just been eyeballs to people for the longest time.
Well, and like I wear glasses too, so you could just wear the mask and you put a hat on, you know.
I could be anybody at this point.
I totally get what you mean, though. There's sort of anonymity is kind of nice, isn't it?
I think I've kind of liked that part of it. I've just started to get out in the world again in the last few weeks, and it's been disorienting to realize, oh no, people are looking at me again, and all of a sudden I might, you know, be judged by people or examined or, you know, befuddle someone, and I might get those questions again. Ah.
Yeah. So there has been a relaxing of that kind of thing and those curious questions that people have. You know, you mentioned that you've been talking about this subject for so long because of your book, but also your festival, which we'll talk about later too. But there are a lot of details in your book, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, about Portland and about living in another country too. I'm wondering, what was the moment that inspired you to write your book?
So honestly, this book has gone through very many iterations. It took me 12 years to write it and get it published. And the genesis of the story, I guess, that really started to hold together was when I read a newspaper article about a family that died in a terrible accident and the girl survived. And I just found myself really obsessed with this story. And I thought, well, I'm going to try to write a story about what happened to that girl, not knowing anything about her, really, just knowing like her name and having seen a picture in the newspaper story. So I tried to write from that space and it just didn't work. I mean, unfortunately, for years, it did not work. And then I realized, and I can't say it was a moment. I wish it had been a moment because then I can manufacture that again for the book that I'm working on right now. But at some point, I came to the realization that there was a reason I was obsessed with that story over all other stories in the world. Why was it that I was obsessed with that story? And I understood inside, but was not able to articulate to myself still at that time, not until the book actually came out and was published, was I able to really articulate this. I was obsessed with the story because it was a story about a girl who was growing up without her mother. And I was trying to figure out what her survival looked like. Now, I still have my mother, thankfully. She just had a birthday yesterday. She's doing well. She's been vaccinated. She's safe. So glad to know all of those things. But there was this way in which I was divorced from her when we came to the States. And I was suddenly in this place where I had to deal with America's ideas about race and beauty. And the fact that, you know, I had a more difficult time claiming my mother because she was a white woman, which is not something I would ever think of her as, even to this day. I mean, if I think of her, I think of her as Danish, I guess. You know, she's not attached to American white identity in any way. So it wasn't a moment exactly, but it was a realization that I wanted to write about someone who was something like me, but more interesting. I mean, that's the trick with the writing.
Well, I first came across it before I even met you, and when it first came out, and I was moved by the poetic writing, and yes, the story of this traumatized child who comes to live with her African-American grandmother after losing her mother and her two siblings in a tragedy. The writing is so poetic and so beautiful and streamlined too, but there's some really great descriptions. I still remember how you described the grandmother as she was shaped like a bullet. And I'm going, I can picture that. And I kind of feel like sometimes I am too, you know? So, you know, immediately saw her. How much of the details of you did you put in there? Because you can't help it, right? Because you're basing it on this experience in Portland and the landscape and the setting. And I'm just wondering how much of it was you?
About 10%. No, I don't know if I could actually measure it or quantify it in any way. But the things that happened in the book didn't happen to me. But the emotional truth of all the things that happen are my own emotional truths in some fashion. And so, yeah, I did give her my eyes. You know, I have blue eyes. My character has blue eyes. She has, you know, fuzzy, curly hair. I have fuzzy, curly hair, thus the hat today. And I did make my character taller than me. She's like at least 5'6" by the end of the book. I'm not close to that.
That's the height you want to be, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. I can't even get there in tall heels. And so it was important for me to make her close to me, but different, because I also needed to be able to write truth. You know, I needed to write an emotional truth through this character without telling my own story, which is memoir. I don't know if I want to share my memoir with people.
I get it. But there are parts of you in there. So I really appreciated that because that rang true to me. I'm wondering, do you have a reading from it that you would, I'm sure you've read it a lot, but I would love to hear it.
I haven't read it in so long. I would love to read it.
Tell us which section you're reading.
Sure. This is actually from chapter 2. So I'm not spoiling anything for you at this point. The book is told in alternating perspectives, and this chapter is told from the perspective of Jamie, a young boy who lives in Chicago where Rachel is living before the tragedy. Jamie thought Robbie was a bird flying down below his window. He had been waiting for this bird and ran downstairs without calling to his mother, "Going outside," which is what his mother had told him to say, even if she didn't hear him above the din of the television that played loudly in her room. Jamie knew that his mother was not watching television. She had a new friend in there. Jamie knew the television as something that made sounds to keep the sound out. He was okay with that. The bird he had waited for had come. Of course, it didn't have to be this one, but it was. There were any number of hundreds of birds that didn't belong in the Chicago sky. There were two windows in his apartment. One faced the alley and the other the courtyard. Jamie didn't watch out the alley window anymore. The things that he'd see fly by were never birds, but garbage bags hurled out the window from higher floors. They sometimes struck the air conditioning units below, whoomp, sometimes catching there and rotting hot during the summer months. Jamie, who was really James, was named after his father, but not named Junior because he was really the third. Jamie wanted a strong name like Steve or Brick. He had been Jamie since he was born, even though there was no way to confuse him with his father, James, a man he had met only in dreams. Jamie, who was really James, ran downstairs to find the bird, to identify it, to see it. He would remember what he saw. He would write it down. He would record the date on his life list, the name of another bird. In his hands, Jamie held a book. It was the only gift he had ever asked for, but the book was not a gift. His birthday, July 23rd, came and went with no celebration and no cake and no gift. Jamie got the book from the library. When the metal detector went off, he laid on the table a pocket knife he had found in the pants draped across the bathtub, the pants of his mother's new friend. "Young man," the stout lady library security guard said, "you know you ain't supposed to be carrying this kind of thing around." Jamie, who was really James, nodded. "I'm gonna keep this here till you come back around with your mama. She says it's okay for you to have it." His plan worked. He left behind the pocket knife, but took with him the Peterson Field Guide to the Birds of Eastern and Central North America. Jamie ran downstairs to the field guide. What is its shape? What shape are its wings? What shape is its bill? What shape is its tail? How does it behave? Does it climb trees? How does it fly? Jamie had memorized these questions from the field guide. He repeated them so much in his head, they seemed to have a melody. He knew the whole topography of a bird. His favorite part of the book was the beginning and the end. Not as if the book held a story, but he loved the two sets of pictures of the bird silhouettes. Number 13 was the magpie, 25 the meadowlark, 9, well, that was the mockingbird, and 14 was the nighthawk. He was certain the silhouette of the great egret had passed his courtyard window. He ran downstairs. One day he would leave the city and find more birds, Jamie thought, as he took the stairs two by two and then slid down the sticky banister on the last three-step flight before the door. He would fill up his life list with birds he could name and call, and when he finally reached the courtyard, he saw that his bird was not a bird at all. His bird was a boy and a girl and a mother and a child. The mother, the girl, the child, they looked like they were sleeping, eyes closed, listless. The baby was still in her mother's arms, a gray sticky porridge pouring from the underside of her head. The girl was heaped on top of the boy's body, a bloody, helpless pillow, and yet there was an old mattress, doughy from rain, just 10 feet from the bird boy's right arm, which was folded like a wing beneath him. Pain moved the boy's body. His bones jutted from his wrists. His eyes were wide open. He can see me, Jamie thought. The boy seemed to have landed feet first on the sodden cement courtyard filled with garbage bags bursting with scent and refuse. The bones from the bottom of the boy's leg poked through his jeans at his thigh. He lay on the ground on his back as if he had fallen from a large, comfortable nest. It was not until the policeman came and raked through the courtyard's waste that Jamie could turn away. The policeman collected matchbooks, soda bottles, and empty brown paper bags, scraps of paper and other possible clues, a Jack of Clubs playing card lying on a brown-stained sheet, and a ticket from Saturday's Quick Pick Lotto. Jamie was still holding his Peterson field guide. He had no names for what he saw.
I remember that from the book, and it is such a tragic image. When you mentioned that you read a newspaper article about this tragedy, was that the tragedy that happened?
Well, so I don't know how to answer that because I don't want to spoil the book exactly.
Right, right.
But when I read this story about the tragedy, I remember at the time that the questions around what happened were, how could this mother do this? You know, how could they let her be a mother, that kind of thing, as opposed to saying, why didn't we help her? Why wasn't there an intervention? Why wasn't there someone else there? And I kept thinking about the fact that there were no witnesses. So how could we really know what was happening? And so this character just really appeared to me. He was not meant to be in the book at all. And I realized, oh, he's got to be here because he's a witness. It's a really important function, especially for a character like Rachel, who's dealing with trauma, that there's someone there who says, you know, I see you, I love you, I do know that you're hurting, you know, and for someone to acknowledge the hurting part of her was really important to be able to tell the story of Rachel.
What you said about the blame that goes into blaming the victim, you know, of a tragedy rather than the questions of why wasn't there somebody to help her? Why, you know, how did she get to this point? You know, why wasn't there intervention? I think still rings true today.
I think it still does. Yeah. I mean, especially in this really difficult year and a half that we've gone through. I mean, there are a lot of people who got hurt and, you know, it's in part because we weren't there for each other.
And society isn't, definitely.
Right, right.
I'm wondering, do you remember at what point you decided to embrace, you know, the identity of being mixed race? Do you remember when that was? For me, it was like in college, I think. It wasn't something I thought about until then.
I think I'd have to say I was well into my 30s. And maybe it wasn't even until I published this book.
Yeah.
Where I could finally acknowledge it. It just seems so dangerous to identify as an Afro-Viking, as I call myself. And it just seemed like I just didn't have the energy to explain myself all the time. I wanted to belong somewhere. So I kind of went along with things. And I did the identity that people picked for me. And that was as far as I could go with it. But I think what happened was that the silence was so crushing to myself, like to my soul, and especially to my creativity. When I kept trying to take like that part of what concerned me out of the writing, it didn't work. Like I was not going to be able to write a story about this girl without addressing the very real struggle that she was having about a mixed race identity. I couldn't just let her be okay and around that one issue, even though she already had this other trauma to deal with. She had this trauma around having to, you know, accept someone else's idea of who she was.
I totally relate to how the process of writing or doing something creative or creating some art helps you to, you know, not figure out, but just really embrace your identity more. And to, it feels like for me, I felt like I was undercover for so long, you know, undercover Asian, right? Until I did May May, A Daughter Song, which is my radio documentary docuplay that I produced in 1989. So that was probably the moment where I started figuring out who I am, not what I am, but who I am.
Yeah, well, I just think it's so powerful to be able to go into the writing or to whatever your art form is and address these issues, because it's really healing to be able to come out on the other side of it. I mean, I also, you know, started therapy at some point in between and was able to start addressing issues that way. But, you know, the art, the writing really, really helped me with realizing like I had to be my whole self in every situation that I possibly could. So yeah, I think I used to have this belief that the artists would lead us to like a new promised land. This was kind of the original idea of the festival Mixed Remix, that we come together through story and we can see beyond difference through stories, whether it be film or books or performance art. Then things changed in 2016, 2017. And unfortunately, I feel less hopeful about the role of the artist in getting us to a next phase as a society. I'm starting to regain that faith again in the last few months, but it's been a real struggle to think about hope in this time.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Mixed Remix Festival, because it was such a great festival. You know, it was the second mixed race festival you founded during Loving Day weekend, and Mixed Remix was free, and it was really the only artistic festival of its kind that really celebrated being mixed race. So with screenings and readings and workshops and just performance. And I thought it was really special. You even had Key and Peele there, you know?
We did that first year. We had Key and Peele there. We did our last big event in 2017, and David Oyelowo was our Storytellers Prize recipient.
That's right.
He was just so lovely. We had a new home at a Los Angeles theater company downtown, and it was a really spectacular event, and it was a labor of love. I mean, I labored over this event, but it wasn't sustainable because we were an all-volunteer effort. So in 2017, we had just had a fantastic event. 23andMe joined on as a sponsor, as a major sponsor, and we were starting to get more and more funding. Still not enough to be able to hire even someone part-time for anything. And we decided we'd go every other year. So 2019, that was our plan, but our small group of volunteers, you know, we ended up having life problems. So, you know, someone's parent had cancer. Another one just had a baby. All sorts of life events intervened, so they weren't able to step up and do the kind of participation that they would normally do. And we were scrambling to figure out, well, how do we find new dedicated people who are going to put their hearts into it in the same way, like on such short notice? And then COVID hit.
And there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but I also think that people are so used to, like with Willamette Writers, of having these virtual conferences, and the cost is, you know, so much more cost effective, and people can actually attend from all over the world, right?
Yes.
So, you know, that might be something to consider in the future, because I think we're used to it now. And I personally think when you can, as mixed race people and interracial families, being able to connect somehow, You know, it takes that feeling of being an other away. It takes the feeling of having no kinship or no community away.
Yes. Yeah, I think I would really love to be able to do this. We've been waiting just because we haven't known what the future has been, you know, in terms of COVID-19 and what that held. But I see us, if we're not doing the giant event soon, I think there might be at least a smaller like online event. And we had also explored a new relationship with a space that had event space for us. They were interested in doing some programming. So we'll circle back with them, you know, probably this summer, early fall, and hopefully we'll be able to start some programming again, because it was a very special event for so many people, I know.
I think it was amazing, frankly. And I think also that so many people still don't know what Loving Day is, or Loving versus Virginia and the importance of that Supreme Court case, because, you know, people don't realize that people were banned from actually marrying because of their race.
I think people are stunned still when I tell them that my parents got married in 1965. And it was illegal for them to marry. So instead of being transferred to South Carolina, where my dad's next station was supposed to be, they were switched to Tacoma, Washington instead, because his CO found out that he had married this white woman. So he's like, okay, well, you can't go to South Carolina. We're going to send you to Washington State instead. This was my parents.
Right. And they could have been put in jail for that, just like the Lovings were for a year. Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it's an important thing to remember and to actually have people celebrate it. I feel like it should be a national holiday, but that's just me, right? Hey, there's Juneteenth, so we're glad about Juneteenth.
Yes.
You know, that was a major thing,
it's
right?
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah. Now, you're the keynote speaker for the Willamette Writers Conference, the virtual conference this year, and you're in conversation with Keisha Ajose-Fisher. She's a Portland author.
Yes, she's a Portland author. I haven't met her in person. I did have a chance to speak with her last week. I've just started to read her wonderful book, No God Like the Mother, which won an Oregon Book Award this year.
Yeah.
I'm excited to speak with her. Well, she has just wonderful energy, and I love her journey story as well to being a published award-winning author, which is really exciting. And I can't wait to hear what we get into. I don't want to preview it too much, but
I'm sure it'll be great. Sure it'll be great having two great, you know, authors connecting with each other, you know, and plus you don't know each other. So it's like you can both like learn more about each other, right?
Exactly. I did learn a little bit about her last week, and I love her.
So in the time remaining, is there anything else you want to talk about, or perhaps what you want people to know about Heidi Duro?
Oh, man. I do want people to know that I am again writing. I was having a very difficult time writing these last few years. So I was just cycling through despair and outrage, being scared for a good part of the last year and a half. And I'm feeling that little bit of hope again, where it feels worthwhile to create and it feels good to create something. So I've been working on adapting The Girl Who Fell from the Sky as a screenplay. So I don't know where that will go, but it's been an interesting process. A script is a very different thing than a book. So we'll see what happens with that. And I have a short story coming out in an anthology next February. It was a stretch, guys. It was a big stretch, but I felt proud of what I came up with. The anthology is called Anonymous Sex. It's erotica by literary fiction writers, all much more famous than me. I don't know how I got into the mix exactly. But the idea behind the collection is that you're going to have a wide range of styles represented, but literary fiction writers doing erotica. And they're just going to list our names in alphabetical order, so you won't know who wrote which sex.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm super excited about being part of that. And then I have some other things in the work. So I'm still working on it, but I really appreciate all of the the questions I get, like, when is the next book coming out? Yeah. I don't know yet, but but it will come out. So stay tuned.
Well, it took you 12 years for the first one. That's all I can say, right?
So I still have a year to go.
You do. You have some time. You have some time. Well, you can find out more about Heidi at HeidiDuro.com. And you can catch her keynote conversation on July 31st at 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. at the Willamette Writers Virtual Conference. Another keynote is with Portland science fiction writer Fonda Lee on July 30th, also at 5:30 p.m. And find out more at willamettewriters.org. Heidi, I'm so glad we finally got this chance to have this conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh my!
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You are such a delight. I love talking to you.
I just enjoy talking with you anytime. It's just we never get to talk very much, so this has been great.
It's been fantastic. Thank you.
Well, that's it for Stage and Studio on Arts Watch this week. You can always catch the show on stageandstudio.org and Arts Watch at orartswatch.org. And also subscribe on any podcast platform and like us on facebook.com/stage_nstudio. Till the next episode, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.